local mill. Work right up, not a mill is ill. I can pay my bills. The evil man is at my door. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. Well, I had me a wife, two kids, a car, and a boat. Things got bad, now the boat won't float. I don't like it. I'm too proud to be born. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working. We're not a working. We're just not working anymore.
Hello, folks, and welcome to the February 4th, 2012 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air by listener-supported WFT Community Radio 90.1 FM in Champaign, Illinois, and webcast worldwide at WFT.org. The views and opinions expressed during this hour of programming are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WFT's management, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Tom to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed or underemployed helpline, call area code 217-469-6111. That's 469-6111. And this hour of programming is being brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. I'm your host, David Johnson, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for us later in the show in the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's poem for this week is from his Cries for Justice collection, is entitled Lay Your Hammers Down. Also here with us today is our new co-host, Pat Simpson, and co-host and founder of the One World Labor Hour, Bill Gorell. Now here's Tom to kick off this week's edition of Workers' Interest News.
The Chrysler Corporation just announced that it is hiring 1,800 workers and is increasing production at its plant in Belvidere, Illinois, a once-dominant manufacturing area that now has the state's highest unemployment rate and has been battered by the economic downturn. The news should provide both financial and psychological boosts to a region that has been bashed by headlines about layoffs and closures for a long time. About 23,000 people in the Rockford-Belvidere area were unemployed in December, and a workforce that numbers over 167,000, this according to state figures. A Chrysler spokesman said that about 500 of the new employees will work on the new Dodge Dart, while the others will be working on the existing Jeep Compass and Liberty models. All are expected to be hired by the third quarter of this year. The plant already employs about 2,700 people and serves to create hundreds of other jobs at nearby parts suppliers and other vendors.
Okay, I got a story. This was tipped to me by Illinois Labor Hour co-founder Peter Miller, who is now a New Hampshire Education Association Uniserv director. And this story is from Durham, New Hampshire, and it does have a local a local connection. You might remember it was around 10 years ago. No, it was longer than that. I think it was back in the 1990s, probably around 1997, 98 maybe. They were building Melrose Place on North Lincoln Avenue. That was student apartments, and that work was done by a company called, or that project was done by a company called Capstone Development Corporation. Well, Capstone's not being very good in Durham, New Hampshire either. And quote, and this is from the seacoastonline.com. Reacting to allegations that 8 construction workers were terminated and evicted after demanding pay for several months of work, about 75 community members and activists held a demonstration Wednesday. Before marching down Main Street, the group left or met in the Durham Community Church to express support for the workers who had helped construct the cottages of Durham on Technology Drive. Maggie Fogarty of the American Friends Service Committee said she was contacted by the immigrant workers after they attempted to acquire, quote, tens of thousands of dollars, unquote, of unpaid wages, and then they were allegedly terminated. Cottage Builders, which is responsible for the development at 50 Technology Drive, is a subsidiary of Capstone Development Corporation. John Aiken, or maybe that's Aiken, it's A-C-K-E-N, Capstone's senior vice president, was at the worksite Wednesday to answer questions, but said he didn't have any specifics regarding the subcontractor responsible for the oversight of the workers. Yes, of course, it's a subcontractor's fault.
Yeah, sure.
Quote, and this is Mr. Aiken, we're working with the attorney that represents these employees, so we have an open dialogue with them, and we hope to resolve this as quickly as possible. Went on to say, we are going to make sure that all the workers are treated fairly. Before marching from the church, the workers' supporters expressed outrage over the alleged abuse. Quote, as a religious leader and a 20-year member of the Durham community, I was shocked and saddened to learn of workers not in some distant faraway place, but here in our community, the community that I love and serve, who have been severely exploited on their construction sites, said Reverend Dr. Mary Westfall, senior minister of Durham Community Church. She said the workers put in hours on Saturdays and Christmas Day. The Reverend Larry Brickner Wood said, in some cases, workers put in 70 to 80 hours a week. Anyway, Fogarty and other activists said the alleged abuse stirred anger and a desire for action in the community. You know, folks, this is really bad that these things go on. And there were some protests back at the Melrose Place situation.
Yes, I knew that name sounded familiar. That's an interesting story, a blast in the past, no less. Involved a lot of, issues. You know.
Yeah, I realized how long ago it was too, because actually one of the old secretary treasurer of Local 703 was out there passing out some leaflets before they got kicked out of the union during the trusteeship. So that place is before 1998.
Yeah, well, maybe Peter Miller can call in sometime and we can do an interview with him, see what he's, you know, what he's been up to in his role there for the New Hampshire Education Association Teachers Union.
Oh, we should have had him be a reporter for the recent primary.
That would be... actually, that's okay. Enough of the circus.
Knowing Peter Miller, he's pretty busy with his work as a Uniserv director, which for people who don't know, it's sort of like he's the business manager for their area.
The teachers and support staff people, yes. Pat?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, good morning. I've got an announcement here about a really exciting film series that's coming up from the U of I Labor Ed program. It's a labor and working class film series. It started January 31st with Modern Times, that wonderful classic with Charlie Chaplin in the factory and showing just what an assembly line really was like. February 14th, coming up on Valentine's Day, we're going to get a working class Valentine and see that old classic, Salt of the Earth.
Oh, yes.
A wonderful film made, as many of you know, by blacklisted members of the Hollywood Ten. And it covers an important strike in New Mexico, known
including
as the Empire.
Grandpa Walton.
That's right, exactly.
The sheriff, didn't he?
Exactly. And so it was also blacklisted actors and actresses mm-hmm. that appeared in that also. Then February 28th, Made in L.A., which is an award-winning film that follows three Latino immigrants working in Los Angeles garment sweatshops. March 13th, Bread and Roses from 2000, a gripping drama based on SEIU's Justice for Janitors campaign mm-hmm. in Los Angeles. April 13th, Office Space. This is a comedy which was written and directed by Mike Judge, and it's become a cult classic.
Yes.
For its rendition of Life in the Cubicles.
Yes, that's a great film. It's our my daughter and my wife, that's one of our family's favorite films. It's a great corporate parody. You know, there's another one that's similar to Office Space that was made back in the 80s with a whole bunch of people in it, like Danny DeVito and, Father Guido Sarducci. And, it's called Head Office. And it's Eddie Albert from Green Acres is in it, too. Office Space, definitely check that out.
Yeah, that is a really, really funny film. And then something I haven't seen yet, but I think is of great interest to people who are interested in what's going on in China in terms of workers. It's called The Last Train Home. It was made in 2009, and it's an award-winning documentary that focuses on the everyday struggles of Chinese factory workers and their families. This film, which follows a single family, tells the story of working people, and according to Roger Ebert, our own hometown guy, it is like stunning, grieving fiction. And of course, part of it is also a lot of these workers are essentially moving into factories in industrial cities, but then having to travel at the holidays on these trains that essentially are sometimes so overloaded or so overburdened that there are accidents, people can't get home. There was a great snowfall a few years back that basically paralyzed the movement of all these people. So it's something to really look forward to. If you want to hear more about or learn more about this program, call 333-0980, and of course that's area code 217, or www.illinoislabored.org.
And where are these films going to be shown again?
They're going to be shown in various places,
okay.
Which is why it's best to either call or get online. Number of them are going to be shown at 101 in the Armory, which is the School of Labor and Industrial Relations building. Mm-hmm. But then there are a couple in different places like 66 Library and 100 Greg Hall.
Okay. All right. Great. Look forward to that. Okay. Caterpillar subsidiary Electromotive Diesel has announced it is transforming the lockout at its London, Ontario diesel locomotive manufacturing facility into a plant closure. 6 weeks ago, Caterpillar locked out the 465 production workers at its London, Ontario plant after they overwhelmingly rejected the company's demand for a 55% wage cut, the elimination of their pension plan, and other sweeping concessions. EMD, that's Electromotive Diesel Incorporated, announced the closure Friday morning in a terse press conference that blamed quote-unquote uncompetitive labor costs and, quote, worker intransience for its decision. The cost structure of the operation was not sustainable, they say, said the release, and, quote, efforts to negotiate a new competitive collective agreement were not successful. Just last week, Caterpillar boasted that the 2011 fiscal year was the most profitable in its history, with profits rising by 83% to $4.9 billion in profits. The EMD announcement set no precise closure date, nor did it indicate where the final assembly operations carried out the London plant will be transferred. However, in seeking to blackmail the London workers into accepting poverty wages, the company has repeatedly pointed to the low-wage contract the United Auto Workers in the United States had imposed on its workers at its LaGrange, Illinois plant, and to its recent opening of a facility in Muncie, Indiana, where workers are paid just $12 an hour. Plant closure will have a devastating impact on London, the Southwest Ontario manufacturing center that is already reeling from the shakeout in North America's auto industry, in addition to the 465 production workers and scores of office and managerial personnel employed at the London EMD plant. The closure announcement directly targets some 2,000 workers in the London area who perform auxiliary tasks for the locomotive plant. The Canadian Auto Workers Union, the bargaining representative for the London Locomotive Workers, quickly signaled that it has no intention of challenging Caterpillar's plan to shutter the London facility. Big mistake. They need to occupy that plant is what they need to do. And if they had a union that was worth its salt, that's exactly what they would call for. And this makes me angry. I don't know what I'm more angry at here, the corporation or the Canadian Auto Workers Union bureaucracy. I mean, it's just, I don't know. Tom?
Another story from Chrysler here. Factory workers for the Chrysler Corporation will be getting profit-sharing checks of about $1,500 apiece next month as they share in the automaker's surprising turnaround. About 26,000 union-represented workers in the U.S. should get the payments under Chrysler's contract with the United Auto Workers Union that was signed last fall. Chrysler would not verify how much the workers would be getting, but the profit-sharing figures are based on analyses of company earnings and the labor contract formula for profit-sharing. The checks are based on Chrysler's $2 billion operating profit for the year 2011. The payments are another sign that Chrysler has recovered from its near collapse in 2009 when it needed a $12.5 billion government bailout and a trip through bankruptcy government loan bankruptcy protection to stay in business. Chrysler has since repaid its U.S. and Canadian government loans by refinancing them, but the U.S. government says it will lose about $1.3 billion on the bailout deal.
Yes, that's another story in itself. Another, of course, the workers, again, got the short end of that stick. We need to get Mike Griffin in here for a show and talk about these issues that have been happening here in the auto industry in the last several years. I'm very opinionated this morning, but I can't help myself. It's just, you know, I read this stuff, this news, and it just makes me angry. But anyway.
Well, if I could just do one comment on the situation in Canada. What's particularly sad is that the Canadian auto workers used to be the most militant branch of the auto workers, the international auto workers, when there was a combined Canadian and U.S. auto worker union. And as a matter of fact, the split occurred on the basis of essentially the Canadians refusing to acquiesce in the early 90s, and I forget the exact date now, but acquiesce to major concession bargaining that the U.S. Branch was essentially agreeing to and then trying to force the Canadians to agree to. So it's particularly sad that it's come to this pass.
Indeed.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the two-tier wage rate, that was really the biggest thing. When they had to give that up, that to me, that's a sign of the downfall of the United Auto Workers right there.
Yeah.
I mean, and since then, Caterpillar's been hiring a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I'm running into people all the time. All these people are middle-aged
mm-hmm.
that are just newly hiring on to Caterpillar in various positions.
Mm-hmm. Low wages, little or no benefits. No job security. I mean, that's the whole thing about these new hires they've been hiring in the last several years, you know. It's just, well, anyway. Tom, do you have anything else on, as far as news stories?
Just one more.
Mm-hmm.
Residents of the Champaign-Urbana area who need help filing taxes can get it from AARP Tax Aid volunteers at the Stevic Senior Center in downtown Champaign beginning February 6th. Volunteers will be at the Senior Center at 48 Main Street from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Monday through Friday and from 9 a.m. to noon Saturdays beginning February 6th and ending April 14th. In past years, tax help was offered at Urbana's Lincoln Square Village, but space was not available there this year, so the volunteers moved to the Stevic Center. Last year, local AARP tax aid volunteers helped more than 2,000 residents file their taxes, but that was down from the 2,400 to 2,500 of previous years because the shortage of volunteers forced the program to cut its hours. This year, 22 new volunteers have bolstered the ranks of volunteers in Champaign County to near 40. In addition to the tax help site in Champaign, AARP tax aid volunteers will offer their services at other locations in Champaign County, including the Rantoul, Mahomet, Philo, and Tolono libraries. But clients need to call ahead to those libraries to arrange appointments.
Okay, thank you, Tom. A little Jim Hightower and some music from Tom Morello, and we'll be right back. You're listening to the Illinois World Labor Hour on community-supported, or listener-supported community radio, WEFT 90.1 FM and www.wft.org, broadcasting from Champaign, Illinois.
Someone you never heard of is the big winner so far in the GOP presidential primaries. I'll tell you who today on Hightower Radio. What happened to Rick Perry, you ask? I'll tell you today on Hightower Radio. To the relief of most Texans, our prodigal governor hath returned. Most presidential pretenders envision a come-from-behind campaign ending in glory. But Rick Perry ran a vainglorious campaign that went in the other direction, ending in oops. What happened to poor Perry was, well, Perry. His brain bone simply does not connect to his tongue muscle, so he fumbled, bumbled, and stumbled through the Republican debates, showing the entire nation that he was not presidential sapling, much less timber. Rick was richly financed by corporate interests, burning through more than $21 million on his political joyride, but he finished a sputtering fifth in Iowa and New Hampshire and was about to be lapped by other in South Carolina before mercifully ending his sad run. Worse, polls showed that he had fallen to third place in his home state. So, he's back. But not to any cheers. The general feeling here is that he embarrassed himself and made Texans look like a bunch of ignorant hillbillies. In a new poll, 45% of Texans say he soiled the state's national image, and 56% don't even want him to run for governor again. Also, Texans are a bit chapped about Perry's prodigality with our money. While he was running around denouncing government spending and berating people who live on government payrolls, Rick kept drawing his $150,000 a year state paycheck, even though he wasn't doing state work. He was also double-dipping, using a special loophole to take $92,000 a year in state retirement pay, while also collecting his gubernatorial salary. Then there's some $2.6 million billed to us to cover the cost of the state security detail that traipsed along with him on the campaign trail. This is Jim Hightower saying, Rick Perry will always be branded nationally as the Oops Guy. But here in Texas, he's called Rick Ouch Perry.
Flag unfurled in city streets across the world, and every bell in the city's rung, every freedom song that's yet unsung. We'll find a voice, we'll find a way to fill the air on the 1st of May. And in the storm we'll bend like the willow. Give
every soul who's perished along freedom's road, at the barricade or in the jail cell. To struggle hard is to struggle well. The struggle is alive today. We're marching out on the 1st of May. And in the storm we'll bend like the willow gear. But together we will stand a wall against the wind. And in the storm we'll bend like the willow gear. But together we will stand, my friend, a wall against the wind. A wall against the wind. A wall against the wind. There are whispers in the migrant field, clenched fists. And in the prison yard, there's a rumor that there's something they might have missed. In every mill and mine and shop, every baton swing of every crooked cop, every dirty threat, every boss's curse. Keep your mouth shut, keep your eyes on your work. I'll take my chances, today's the day. The clock ticks down till the 1st of May. And in the storm we'll bend like the willow gear. But together we will stand a wall against the wind. And in the storm
we'll... Okay, we're now at that point in the Illinois World Labor Hour for the Cultural Corner with Tom's poem, Lay Your Hammers Down.
What giants are devouring us in this so-called land of the free? What liars and thieves steal what's ours through systems that should just not be? What neocons suck all the blood of the poor, the weak, the infirm? What CEOs claim to have souls yet can't even define the term? Though slavery was outlawed once, why is it making a comeback? If our nation does have a soul, then why is justice at a lack? How can the evil be shut down and never be allowed again? Unity is what it will take of all working women and men. Lay your hammers down, all workers. Stop your machines and have a seat. It's time to let that dictator's clique know that justice is on its beat. Workers all standing together are America's greatest might. To free our land from tyranny, together we'll carry the fight. As one great union united, democracy can be our prize. If we just stand up together, we can end their treacherous lies. Lay Your Hammers Down was written in Bullfrog Hollow, Vermont in the summer of 2006 and was brought to you live today, February 4th, 2012, here on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Just, you know, in relation to that Tom Morello song that played before your poem, you know, Wall Against the Wind, about the 1st of May and all that, and then this song, this poem about Lay Your Hammers Down, reminded me there's a rumor going around on the internet that the Occupy movement is going to be calling for an actual general strike on May 1st of this year.
I heard something about that, a nationwide strike.
A nationwide general strike, which could possibly spread internationally, too. So we'll keep you posted on that as we hear more you know, definitive things on that. But anyway, for some public service announcements, the University YMCA Friday's Forum is going to be happening starting, well, actually it started this last Friday on February 3rd, and it's going to continue on through Friday the 13th, April 13th, and that's at 1001 South Wright Street, Latzer Hall, on the University of Illinois campus, and on Friday, April 13th, I wanted us to highlight a local person who used to live here, Mark Weisbrot, who is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, is going to come home, and he's going to be talking about debts and deficits, combating recession in the U.S., Latin America, and the Eurozone. So that's on Friday the 13th. April 13th. So definitely check that out. Also, tune in this Sunday and every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. on Urbana Public Television, Comcast Channel 6 for Labor's Worldview TV. This week, there's going to be a section on Occupy Oakland. The events that happened last Sunday where the police basically viciously attacked the Occupy Oakland people for trying to occupy a vacant building to open a community center. Property over people. And also coming up here on Sunday, there's going to be an Occupy the Super Bowl here happening this Sunday. I guess Indiana pushed through a so-called right-to-work bill, a right-to-work for less. And I guess, you know, there's going to be a lot of resistance to that. I guess they're going to spoil probably Madonna's appearance at the halftime and everything. But, this is what happens. What's the old saying? No justice, no peace. So, and last but not least, speaking of peace, today from 2 to 4 p.m. is the monthly anti-war demonstration by the local AWARE anti-war and racism effort in downtown Champaign at the corner of Neal and Main. Good time to come out because it's also the National Day of Mass Action to stop the war, to stop the proposed war on Iran. So come on out today, downtown Champaign, corner of Neal and Main from 2 to 4 p.m.
So. Hey, Dave, I'm going to throw something out here.
Sure.
It's sort of like a little contest here, but at least between us. Perhaps somebody could call in if they know the answer. And what it is, I'm going to read you some lyrics to a fairly new song from a very long-awaited album where a band has got back together, a very beloved band by many people. And anyway, here are the lyrics. This is the last verse of the song. Uncle Danny had Uncle Daddy Danny had a coal tattoo. I'm sorry, folks. This is written out in somebody else's handwriting. Uncle Danny had a coal tattoo. He fought for the Union, as some of us do. On his shoulder is the number of the chapter that he is in. That number's there forever, like his struggle to win.
Okay. I have no clue.
Just got back together, eh?
Yeah, and they were really huge many years ago, and they've been through some changes. And anyway, I do have some audio here where the guy who wrote those lyrics explains them and why he wrote them. I could go ahead and play that, Dave.
Mm-hmm.
I can plug in here. Get your auxiliary channel ready.
It's ready.
All right. Set it on warp 3.
Okay.
And here's the person that wrote those lyrics.
Sorry, I promised no philosophy before happy hour. Let's continue. Not all tattoos, as I perhaps just described, are for fun or for flavor or for color. They identify your very most core beliefs, whether it's religious or, as I describe in the song, Uncle Danny had a coal tattoo. It's from working in the mines. In fact, that's not really a tattoo at all. It's when the black coal dust, I think it's called the bituminin, gets so far into your pores that you can no longer scrub it out, or that if you could, you would rub your skin virtually raw. And pretty soon you start to have a kind of, it looks like a splotching effect. It's coal tattoo, and it identifies very clearly what it is you've been doing for a living for a long time. And it describes how the number of his Union chapter is on his shoulder, and he wears it forever. Uncle Danny had a coal tattoo. He worked for the unions, and some of us still do. And on my shoulder is the number of the chapter he was in, and that number is forever, like the struggle here to win. What's more poignant than the union struggle today? You identify that. You join a team. You join a group. Join a neighborhood frequently when you put on a tattoo. So they're not all just for celebration. They're not all just for decoration. And once again, when Swap Meet Sally gets that tramp stamp tat.
Okay. Do any of you guys have an idea of what your guess is on this?
I don't know, Bill. Somebody wants to call in. They could call in at 359-5483. If they know the answer to that. I mean, I know it's not the only person I could think of was Kris Kristofferson, but I don't think so.
I don't know if Kris Kristofferson would be offended at that or not. I'm not sure.
No.
But it's not Kris Kristofferson.
Okay.
His voice is much grandfather these days.
But, yeah, it's a very nice comparison. I'm sure that the person who wrote those lyrics would like to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I actually have the song here. I'm going to go ahead and reveal who it is.
Okay.
It's not Mellencamp, is it?
No, it's not John Mellencamp, but it is kind of a contemporary of John Mellencamp as far as being a big star. So, Dave, get ready there on the auxiliary channel again.
Ready to go.
And we'll take a little break here, and maybe you'll recognize this performing group that wrote this song, and you will probably be very surprised. They are not known for their social commentary.
Okay. Okay, Bill. Tell us who it is.
Yes, folks, that is Van Halen's new single, and that was David Lee Roth that gave you the very poignant story of his Uncle Dan, the coal miner.
Unbelievable. You know, I saw an interview with David Lee Roth back in the 80s where he was really bashing on the band, the political band, The Clash. You know, basically saying that they didn't know what they were talking about and everyone has bosses, so what's the big deal? What happened?
Well, I don't have all the details right here at hand, but I do remember that after he split up with Van Halen, and by the way, the band is really Van Halen now, as nepotism works in that band, with Eddie having his son playing bass now and his brother on drums. But anyway, David, his career, he had put out maybe one or two solo albums. Then he had a failed radio show in New York City, like a talk radio show, and he was an EMT for a while.
Are you kidding me?
So he's kind of rejoined the working class for at least some time, and And also, it's look at the atmosphere in which he wrote that song. It was probably written in the last year or so.
Mm-hmm.
And there's finally maybe, you know, there was the Wisconsin movement and then Occupy Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
excuse me. And I think I'm hoping very much when we started this show in the mid-90s, was during a time of a lot of labor problems here in central Illinois. And it seemed like at that time that labor was starting to make a comeback.
Yes.
In fact, there was a Van Halen album from the 90s that I remember, and it has the only other song that sounds political at all, except I'm not sure by the lyrics where the politics of the song is, but it was a Van Halen song called Ballot or Bullets.
Oh, really?
I think it was off the Van Halen 3 album where they had the guy that everybody hated singing for him, and I don't mean Sammy Hagar.
Uh-huh.
But in the midnight, and then George Bush got elected, mm-hmm. and the Twin Towers were attacked,
mm-hmm.
and then everything just went to hell in a handbasket.
You know, think about, too, the late 90s, there was a lot of political activism on campus, the anti-sweatshop initiatives.
That's right.
There was the WTO, Battle of Seattle, that happened. Like, oh, I remember that time. That's when I got back involved in the union movement, like the mid-90s. And, oh, man, things were moving, things were happening, and you're right. And it wasn't so much a George Bush's election as it was 9/11.
Yeah, I mean,
how convenient for the ruling class.
Well, yes, and
we'll go into that some other show.
You're a truther.
Well, I'm about conspiracy. Fact, not conspiracy theory. So I'll leave it at that.
Well, the accepted official story, by the way, is a conspiracy.
That's
a
true.
A conspiracy of 19 Arabs.
Yeah, with box cutters. And let us not get off on that tangent. But anyway, we just had... this is interesting, Bill. I mean, you know, I think we need to point these things out from time to time about, you know, the reflection of the times in culture, you know, in music, film, you know, poetry, or, you know, whatever, because believe it or not, there's so much. I mean, there's so much cultural propaganda in the entertainment we watch and consume out there. Believe me, I mean, it's rampant with it. So, I mean, we need to be aware of pro working class and, you know, other types of culture out there to let our listeners know and that we need to, you know, check out too.
By the way, here's another blast from the past.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody who is known as sort of a somewhat of a working class cultural icon due to her TV show.
Uh-huh.
And that is Roseanne Barr.
Oh, yes.
Is running for the Green Party nomination.
Are you kidding? Where, in Hawaii? Or?
For president.
Oh, for president? For president? No, wait a minute. There's some other woman running for president.
Well, I know Roseanne Barr is, though. I know.
Oh,
that.
They're having their primaries. Okay.
I mean, I don't know how the Greens have it.
Yeah, they have a primary, too. Yeah, I bet that won't get any coverage.
Yeah. Are they still on the ballot in Illinois?
Yes, they are.
Okay. But what I'm going to talk about culture a little bit is that, culture is usually defined as how a society transmits its values.
True.
Well, and I think it also...
Through entertainment, yeah.
And in a really diverse society like this, we have many subcultures transmitting and creating and... many values, and I've been thinking about this a lot this week because I just watched a 4-hour documentary series The Century of the Self.
The Century of the Self, okay.
Yes, and it's by this documentary producer and writer in England who's been working since the early 80s,
mm-hmm.
and this is the second thing of his that I've seen. The first one I saw was The Power of Nightmares, where he explained the background to Islamic extremism and the reaction from the West. It was a very pretty good movie. A lot of people watched not long after 9/11. But this one, The Century of the Self, is about, one of the reasons I'm interested, I minored in public relations, and I think public relations is the most evil field.
Who's the father of public relations? I never can remember his name.
The father of public relations figures very highly in this series, and his name was Edward Bernays. He was somehow a double nephew of Sigmund Freud, and uh-huh. he was very close to Freud,
yeah.
and he used Freud's ideas. Now, public relations began with the Creel Commission, pretty much, for World War I, where within a very short period of time, they swung the United States from being probably an overwhelming majority against taking part in World War One, swung it completely around to where we couldn't wait to get over there, you know, the song.
Sure.
And take down some terrible evil Huns.
Yeah.
And then after that, there was the big Red Scare and the deportations and all.
Of Emma Goldman and Big Bill Haywood, yes.
And what happened was people like Edward Bernays, who is, I believe he was part of the Creole Commission, his idea was using his uncle's theories on the unconscious and how we're driven by all of these fears and terrible dark drives. It's like, God, Sigmund Freud's sort of like a psychiatric Thomas Hobbes, you know. It's like the back of your mind is nasty, brutish, and short, you know. And I don't know. I still can't figure out how toilet training has had so much to do with my life. You know, what is... I mean, I think Freudian psychology says a lot more about Sigmund Freud than it says about anybody else.
Indeed.
Well, anyway, but if you take these things and you use media and all the media that you can, including a big parade where he popularized smoking among women. So the guy is basically, on that alone, responsible for tens of millions of deaths.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Edward Bernays was a terrible social climbing pipsqueak of a man.
Okay.
And what he did was they had a big, I can't remember what the, it's like the Easter parade or something in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so he got a bunch of debutantes who were marching in it to smoke cigarettes. And that opened the way for women to be able to smoke cigarettes. And of course, it all has to do with cigarettes being a phallic symbol. And
let's not get too Freud here.
I don't mind the cigar metaphor, but the cigarette's getting a little diminutive. But it's, I mean, and it just based this huge propaganda campaign with corporate America and the government, and it became what's going on in this documentary is it's portraying like a battle between New Deal rationalism.
Mm-hmm.
And Bernays's Freudian public relations.
Okay.
And then after World War II, it was thought by the powers that be, what I'm going to start calling, bringing back a 60s term, the establishment.
Mm-hmm.
Business, government,
the
top 1%. Echelons of labor.
Yes.
And academia.
Mm-hmm.
That what had happened in Germany in World War II was due to the dark drives, blah, 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 in the back of people's heads. You know, of course, it didn't happen in the United States where we dealt with things rationally.
Uh-huh.
It happened in Germany where, I mean, Adolf Hitler was very much into the occult, and the SS itself was developing, this isn't from the movie, it's from other sources,
mm-hmm.
was developing its own religion
mm-hmm.
Based on the Teutonic mythology. But anyway...
Right.
What they wanted to employ Freudianism to, according to Curtis, and he's been criticized for this, to keep those things tamped down so we wouldn't have a fascist thing again. And critics from the left tell Curtis, well, no, it's about consumerism. But anyway, there's more to it.
Yeah.
We got Jermaine here. Maybe I'll do something more organized about it at some point. But I think it's the thing. It's why we have things like What's the Matter with Kansas? It's why there's
a book by Thomas Frank.
Right. It's why there's an article here. I don't have it right now, that talks about how the majority of Republicans who earn less than $30,000 a year, they say the government needs to help people more, which is far from the Republican idea. But the thing is, why are these people Republicans anyway?
Yeah,
there's a lot of answers to that, but I think a lot of it has to do with this long-term public relations campaign that is somewhat organized by, quote, the establishment.
Yeah, identity politics and wedge issues. Sure, sure. Well, this is fascinating, Bill. And yes,
what I mean is using psychological. Yes. These are psyops operations.
Sure.
Much like the military uses.
Yes.
And
it's
not just that, and it's not just politics. It's deep psychology, and it mutated in the 70s and 80s, and I'd like to talk about that sometime, too.
Sure, sure.
And we're going to talk to
Jack. And going back to the original point about how culture plays a very important part. You know, in you know, our lives, you know, and it's used for propaganda. You know, every day, every single day, every day you turn that television on, there's propaganda in television, in sitcoms, in movies, sporting events, everything, everything that comes out of the cultural gristmill, if you will.
Yes, and every commercial, every advertisement is not just an advertisement for a product; it's an advertisement for capitalism.
Oh, indeed,
and
indeed.
Consumerism.
Yeah.
But anyway, Jermaine, what's
sure.
happening?
Yes. Okay, Jermaine. Speaking of working class women heroes like Roseanne Barr, welcome Jermaine Light back to the show. Jermaine, what's been going on with you lately?
Well, I'm really concerned about pensions, of course.
Okay.
And it seems that the governor and certainly, Senate Democratic, John Cullerton, Senate President John Cullerton, have been entertaining ideas of moving the pension responsibilities from the state to the local school districts. And they've been entertaining other ideas. I mean, I should say some other legislators have been entertaining a number of different ideas.
And this is here in Illinois or nationwide?
In Illinois.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, you know, this is really, I don't understand. IEA hasn't, my union, Illinois Education Association, has not taken a position on this as of yet, as of February 1st at least. And so I don't know what to think about this. I'm not even sure it sounds constitutional, the way things
when does
are
that
set
ever
up.
Stop them?
Right. It's very, very scary. I can't imagine how they would do this.
The state constitution definitely stops a progressive income tax. You bring that up to a politician. Oh, we can't do that. We never.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Jermaine, question. Is the IEA not taking a stand yet because there actually is a division or differing opinions on this plan? Or is it just that it's been thrown at them and they just haven't had time to respond?
It may be a time factor. I'm not completely clear. They also want to make sure that they might want to leave it open for a little bit here because they're so concerned about being at the table. Mm-hmm. And if they say, you know, no, a blank no to everything, I think some of the leaders are afraid that they're not going to be at the table then.
Huh.
But right now the governor is setting up a panel, or either has set up or is setting up a panel, a committee, to discuss the pension problem and to look at some of the different ideas. And he had a meeting with union leaders, in, not just IEA, but IFT, AFSCME, SEIU, and AFL-CIO, on January 24th, and they talked about the problem, and he said he was hoping that the unions would come up with some ideas. And the unions are anticipating, but they didn't say this was for sure, that they would be allowed to meet with the panel. So, I mean, this is sounding kind of pretty scary, and I don't know how local school districts would be able to take over our pensions. I don't understand that whole thing and how it would be done and what that would do to our pensions. Or, like I said, if they may have to change the Constitution. I don't know. I just don't understand all of this. But it does sound like something for a lot of concern. And
Also, I think that in terms of the local school districts, the question becomes one of can they afford it?
Well, indeed.
At this particular point in time, they're already laying off people and projecting there may be more layoffs. And to assume in a burden like that would just really become a very, very serious problem.
Right. Now, in some school districts, like the one I'm teaching in, I'm lucky that they pay for our pension contribution. But, I mean, we say they pay it, but actually it's part of our benefits, right?
Exactly.
It's money
so we
that
really
could,
it's,
go, in your
could go in our salary, you know, right, if they weren't doing that. So we always consider it part of our salary.
It's part of your wage
really
package.
Really, it's part of our wage. And in some school districts they don't do that. But perhaps, you know, like you say, they would pay a smaller wage if they did contribute to the TRS, Teachers Retirement Service. And then another problem too, besides what you said, Pat, is the disparity this is going to cause. If the local school districts would be responsible for even part of our pensions. In a, differently than they are now, or more than they are now, then, you know, some school districts are so, so poor, and others are have a lot of money, and so we're going to, it's just going to make the disparity that we have, the disparity in the rich districts compared to this poor district,
sure,
much, much worse than it already is.
Well, I hope the Illinois Education Association leadership handles this better than they did that Senate bill, what was it?
Seven?
Yes, Senate Bill 7. I mean, what a capitulation. And then they're trying to celebrate it like it's a victory, you know? And then later after the fact, they get that audio tape from the guy that pushed the campaign to begin with, bragging and laughing about how they pulled the wool over the eyes and bluffed the teachers union into rolling over, you know, on this. And, of course, you know, threatening and bribing state legislate, you know, Senate and, you know, representatives to back this thing. I mean, to me, just not knowing any more about the issue than what you mentioned, it sounds to me like the state's trying to just pass the buck, if you will. They borrowed from that fund.
They've been passing the buck for decades, and yes, that's why they have this problem?
Yeah, well, also, you got to remember,
that's right,
the pension fund, the reason the pension funds are in bad shape is because the state took money, borrowed money from it, never paid it back, and then now is trying to make the workers who they borrowed the money from pay back what they spent. I mean, it's just outrageous,
yeah,
you know?
It also, I mean, I, for a period of time, worked for the Pennsylvania State Education Association in the 90s, going back to the 90s as a somewhat more hopeful period,
mm-hmm,
where educational equity, and of course what that really is about is figuring out ways to essentially equalize the monies that are available to school districts, so poor districts or school districts are not suffering, and their children suffering, and their teachers suffering, and their communities because of this. Well, this whole issue of educational equity, I mean, nobody talks about that anymore.
No, all you hear is about is concessions and cutbacks and, you know, funding shortfalls. And, I mean, this is all part of the attempt to, you know, basically starve the death of the public sector, you know, especially,
well,
you know, education.
Here's where I think that the labor movement is falling down by just working on only shop floor issues, basically. The biggest, the core problem in the United States as a whole when it comes to things like this is that we need to go back to the pre-Reagan income tax system,
mm-hmm,
and that these states, in Illinois, the person in the lowest 20% pays, when you combine all their taxes together, pays 13.1% of their income in taxes. Meanwhile, the top 1% only pays 4.1%.
Are you kidding me?
And that's all taxes put together.
Mm-hmm.
The states and they need to get together and forget this going down the road, you know, of just giving everything up to corporations. I mean, the states need to get together. Maybe they need to do some kind of an agreement, mm-hmm, overall, but, mm-hmm, you know, no more race to the bottom.
Right, right.
We need good tax structures in the states and the federal government. So the federal government can, that's the whole point of the income tax. And it's a good thing, but it's being damned. It is for the redistribution of income and wealth in this country.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sorry. Jermaine?
Are we closing off here?
No.
We're going on till 1 today?
No. But okay, you got a couple more minutes.
Oh, well, I'm just going to say there's four other things they've been looking at.
Mm-hmm.
One, and that's okay, increasing member contributions.
Mm-hmm.
Creating a pension stabilization fund with dedicated revenue from something such as gaming.
Okay.
Okay. And modification of actual benefits like COLA, the cost of living raise, retirement age, so you'd have to work longer,
mm-hmm,
multiplier, final average salary. And the last one is reducing the funding target for the state systems to be at 90% paid by 2045. I'm sorry, to be 80% paid by 2045 instead of the targeted, you know, present goal of 90%.
Everything paid. But what they should be doing, and that's taxing the rich and, well, making them pay their fair share.
That's what we need, is a graduated tax system.
Yes.
In to make our system at least as progressive, yeah, as our federal, and maybe we should be doing even better than that.
Yes.
And our federal, yes, should, indeed, be more progressive,
John,
too.
Jimmy John should be paying a higher rate of taxes than we are.
And what his workers are paying.
No matter what state he moves to.
Oh, indeed. And but anyway, okay, you've been listening to the Illinois World Labor Hour at community listener-supported community radio in Champaign, Illinois at 90.1 FM and webcast worldwide live at weft.org. We're going to leave you here with a little Tom Morello, and stay tuned.